I'm John Marquistad from St. Olaf College, and I've been here for the month of June. And I've been talking in my sessions about women and the visual arts. And during the past year at school, I developed some courses, or a course, on this topic. And so I felt that it was something that our department should be doing. My teaching is primarily in art history, but I do studio work, and I'm a painter, chiseler, welder, all those kinds of things. I'm not exactly a scholar in art history. I talk about art history from the point of view of one who knows what paint smells like. And for a number of reasons, I got interested in the problem of the treatment of women in art, and also the absence of women artists in the art history textbooks, and why in general there don't seem to be any great women artists in the past or in the present. So I developed a seminar where we looked at some of those themes. What I want to do today is sort of a potpourri. I'm going to touch on some of the topics I've been dealing with all month. And I'd like to try to also introduce a couple of people I haven't gotten to in my slide collections. Two German women, Katie Kollwitz and Paula Moderson Becker, and two American photographers, Dorothea Lange and Diane Arbus. But before I do that, I'd like to make some general statements about the problem. When you look at the history of art, it's a history written by men, and it's mainly about male artists who are working for male patrons. And this makes a big difference. And I'd like to look at the way, just in about three examples, the image of woman has been treated in art history. I'd like to look at two pairs of paintings, one by a woman and one by a man, on the same subject, so we can see that there really is a different point of view. Then I'd like to make some generalizations about male and female art forms in the 20th century, and then we'll look at these women. But there's a book by John Berger called Ways of Seeing, and in this book there's a chapter, this was a British Broadcasting Company television series, and there's a chapter which points out how women have been depicted as objects in the history of art. And I think the best example of that is the beauty contest. This is a painting by Lucas Cranach, who happened to be an admirer of Luther and painted a number of portraits of Luther. And the subject is the Judgment of Paris, and it's about the beauty contest. These three most beautiful women, including Helen of Troy, Venus and so on, ask this poor passerby named Paris, this shepherd, who is the fairest of us all? Who's the most beautiful one of us? And so Paris has to choose one of them, and he gives that person the golden apple. And the Trojan War was caused because the person who lost was disgruntled. The problem is, you're either beautiful or you aren't. So if you win a beauty contest, you're a winner. If you're a loser, you're not Miss Runner-Up USA. You are ugly. You're a failure. That seems to be what's operating behind a beauty contest. And on television, when the queen is announced, all the other princesses try to be really nice about it, and they run over and give her a big hug. But you know they want to kill her. So there's that strange phenomenon of the beauty contest. In my neighborhood, there's a little town called Waterville in southeastern Minnesota, and there's a muddy lake, and Iowa people go up north to go fishing, and when we think about going up north, we think about going to Canada, but they come up to southern Minnesota to fish in this muddy lake, and they catch bullheads, and there's a Miss Bullhead contest in the summer, which is kind of a strange title for a contest, but you all know about contests in your own backyard. Well, the point is, the winner, or all three of these women, are objects to be seen. And John Berger points out how women, from the very earliest age, are socialized to be aware of themselves as appearances. Women are to be seen, and everything about the way they're raised contributes to this idea. The way they talk, the way they walk, the way they use their hands, the way they dress, they're always aware of themselves being seen. And they're being seen, we assume, by men. And John Berger's contention is that it is men who act and women who are seen, who are being seen. And women are aware of themselves as appearances because that's the way they're brought up to be. And so, in a sense, women, there's a male aspect to a woman because she's aware of herself being seen. So she's always looking at herself. So in a sense, the woman herself is turning herself into an object. And when you turn yourself into an object, you're probably going to be used like one. So there are all kinds of images of the judgment of Paris in the history of art. And it's basically about the beauty contest. And we can assume that the judge in this case owns the woman that he chooses. She becomes his possession. And then we can also assume that the artist is a man, we know it is, and that the client for this painting is also a man, and he's not really interested in mythology. He's interested in collecting three things, three appearances, three of the most beautiful women in the history of the universe. This is Titian, and he's a big gun in the Venetian Renaissance in the 16th century, and he paints Venus admiring herself in the mirror. Venus is the manifestation of truth, beauty, and goodness. And allegorically, Venus gets involved in the Renaissance and becomes, she does represent a kind of Christian metaphor. But I don't think we can call this a Christian metaphor. This is simply an occasion to look at this image of the most beautiful woman as they saw it at that time. This was that society's idea of what the perfect form was like. It's a very voluptuous, very sumptuous, robust, I would say somewhat fat, but we don't use that word, just voluptuous image of the woman. But she's looking in the mirror, and she knows that we're looking at her. So she's aware of herself being looked at. And she also is just simply looking at herself. If we wanted to, we could make moral judgments about this woman, because looking in the mirror is not a good thing to do. It's a symbol, or it's an image of vanity. And so we can say this greedy, egocentric woman spends her life staring at herself, and that's not a nice thing to do. So that sort of legitimizes our act of staring at her. One more. This is from the 17th century in Spain. It's called the Rokeby Venus by a painter named Velázquez. And he has posed the figure. So there's a man who has set up the painting. And we assume that the painting is being made for a man. And the man is going to, supposedly, he's an educated person who likes to think about classical mythology. But it's an occasion to stare at this female form, this appearance. And she, too, again, is looking in the mirror, looking at us, looking at her. One more of these older paintings. This is from a period right after the Reformation. The period is called Mannerism. The artist's name is Bronzino, an Italian. And this painting was a gift from the Duke of Tuscany, where the city of Florence is, to the King of France. And the title is The Exposure of Luxury, or sometimes it's called Venus, Love, Time, Cupid, and Folly. And maybe there's a complicated subject matter here, which we don't really have to get into. on one level, it's a kind of hellfire and brimstone sermon, but I don't think we'd ever get converted by it. I think it's more an occasion to vicariously participate in whatever sinister thing is going on. It's a disturbing painting because Cupid, who is Venus's son, is making love to his own mother. That's kind of an uncomfortable thing to be observing. And then there are different kinds of people reacting to that in the background. You can't see some of the details, but there's an old woman tearing her hair, and there's this other Cupid figure throwing flowers at the mother to stimulate this activity. But what's important is that the woman is presented frontally. She's straight on to the viewer, who is the King of France. She's painted with absolute perfection. She's this kind of porcelain doll. But an important detail is that she has no pubic hair. The hair on her head is very carefully coiffed or arranged. Hair is a symbol of, or an image of passion or emotion or feeling. And John Berger insists that because the painter leaves those elements out of the painting, it suggests that this woman is without feeling, and that she is not there. She has no sexual appetites of any kind. She is only there to satisfy the sexual appetites of the viewer. She is a feelingless, sexless thing, an appearance. And furthermore, she's not even a person. Because of the way she's painted, there are no blemishes. There's nothing to distinguish her as a human being. Rather, she is this creation of the mind, this abstraction. And this I think we could simply call dehumanization. And this is the way the image of woman has appeared throughout the history of art. I mean, you look at all the old masters, even Rembrandt, whom I admire a great deal. Sometimes Rembrandt is guilty of this as well. We're just so conditioned in this direction. Well, this is a painting by a 19th century French artist named Bouguereau, and it was commissioned by Hoffman's Bar in New York City. And this was a bar where statesmen of this country and corporation executives and diplomats and leaders met to negotiate something. And somebody wins in a negotiation and somebody loses. And the loser might just have lost United States Steel, but it doesn't matter because he looks up above the bar and there's this painting of these nymphs dragging this male satyr off into the woods to do their nymphly thing. And so he says, well, it doesn't matter if I lost my corporation, I'm still a man and women like me. And so this is a painting designed to flatter the male ego. And that seems to be a strong thrust in a lot of Western European art. We don't find the same thing in other cultures. In Indian art, in Persian art, Chinese art, the art of South America, pre-Columbian art, you find a different approach to the image of the male and the female. They usually are presented as active partners, as mutually involved people, supporting each other. It's just in the Western world that there's this strange divorce, and that the woman becomes a thing, and it's the man who does whatever it is he has to do. And I suppose it all goes back to Eve, who is blamed for whatever problems we face. And man is assigned the job by God to do something about it. So there's this lifelong sort of, I would say, persecution of Eve, only resolved by the cult of Mary, by the idea of monasticism, by some of those kinds of shifts where woman, in a sense, can redeem herself. Well, this is there to satisfy the male viewer. And I only have to make reference to all the girly magazines and modern advertising, and we're seeing it coming in television, different kinds of standards about ways to sell underwear. which I would suspect are it's going to get rather offensive. And when I'm talking here at Holden, I'm talking to the wrong people. But I think these are real problems, and that most of the world, most of the time, at least in the Western world, is shaped by these values that haven't really changed. But there are modern artists who I think are deeply disturbed by these kinds of things. Maybe they don't have anything positive to offer, but there are a lot of strong, kind of truthful statements. This is Tom Wesselman, and it's called The Smoker. And in a sense, Tom Wesselman is calling a spade a spade. He reduces the woman to an orifice covered with some kind of plastic material made by Revlon. She has no face, no eyes, no gestures, no subjectivity. She's just this orifice. And she has these elegantly crafted fingers covered also with some kind of plastic material. And the smoke is a strangely provocative shape. It's perfectly crafted. The edge of the canvas, this is a painting on a canvas. The edge of the canvas is the edge of the painted form, the smoke around the hand. So the frame that the canvas is stretched on is very well made, kind of a manifestation of good, solid American craftsmanship. And then it's perfectly painted, but it's absolutely, it reduces the female form to a provocative sort of phallic cigarette shape and this mouth. This is one more Tom Wesselman, and then I'll get off this subject. But I think these are very disturbing paintings. I mentioned in an earlier session that I put the previous one on a final exam, and I played it against a painting of a rather ordinary-looking woman, but she was real. I mean, a real, living, breathing person. And I had the class compare the two, and then I said, you're a buyer for your corporation that you got a job from. They heard you had this nifty art course at St. Olaf, so now you're well-qualified as a judge. You have to go out and buy a collection for this corporation. So I said, you have to buy one of these, and then you have to justify to the chairman of the board why you chose what you did. Well, most of the class chose this one. And I thought they liked it because it was so nicely done and clean and good craftsmanship and skillful and all that, but they were absolutely immune to what this the devastating thing that this artist was trying to say. And I'd been haranguing about these things during the semester, and somehow they must have all been asleep because it didn't make a dent. They'd rather have a slick, faceless painting with ambiguous shapes, with double meanings, maybe things that you can snicker about. They'd rather have that hanging in their living room than a picture of honesty or truthfulness. So I don't know what we do about this. One other little story. We had to go out 2 weekends ago, and we were in Seattle on a Saturday night, and there were two late teenage girls in the house where we were staying. And they were getting dressed up to go out on Saturday night. And this one, the younger girl had on this skirt that looked to me like it was about 3 inches long. And it was so tight. I mean, it would take an act of Congress to get inside of that skirt. And she had this really interesting makeup on and this wild hair and all this jewelry and shoes and... She asked her sister, how do I look? And her sister said, pure sin. And so that meant she looked pretty good. And they were going to go out and cruise on Broadway in Seattle. Well, I don't know how they could go out there and not get picked up. That's the point of it. But I have to admit that I thought it was really fun. And I enjoyed watching these girls get ready to go out on Saturday night. And I thought their outlandish appearance was wonderful. Then I said, no, I'm not supposed to say those kinds of things. I'm at Holden Village giving lectures about this isn't right. So I don't know what the solution is. Two painters, male and female, on the same subject. The subject is Susanna and the Elders. And Susanna is in the apocryphal book of Daniel. She was an heroic Israeli woman, a real model of commitment, of stature, of high values, high purpose, a woman who loved God and who was absolutely faithful to her husband. And her husband was away. The elders of the community know that she's a very beautiful woman, and they sneak over, they're down at the pool hall or down at the temple or someplace, and they start talking, men talk, and they decide, well, let's go have this little adventure and go spy on Susanna. So they do, and then they get aroused, and then they proposition Susanna, and she repels them. And they say, if you don't go along with us, we're going to smear your name in the community. She says, no, I belong to my husband. And so they do proceed to smear her. She complains to Daniel, the judge. This is not the writer of the book. The judge rules against the men. The men are taken outside of the city, and they're stoned to death. Well, no artist ever talks about that. All they ever talk about is this voyeuristic act of spying on Susanna. This is a male artist, Tintoretto. There's a man down in the corner here, and there's one up at the top, peeking behind this bower of flowers. Susanna has a foot in the water. Water is a very provocative kind of symbol of fertility, and it has erotic overtones. Also, the slide doesn't show it. It's not a very good slide, but the slide doesn't show it, but there are a lot of flowers in that fence that the men are peeking behind, and flowers smell good, and flowers are erotically suggestive. And then the woman herself is a voluptuous goddess, and she also is looking in the mirror, and I don't know if she's looking in the mirror watching us look at her, but it has nothing to do with an heroic woman. Rather, it's an occasion for legitimized voyeurism, a legitimized peeping Tomism. And this is the way, this is a very popular subject in the 15th, 16th, 17th, and way into the 18th century, and there are hundreds of versions of this painting made, and never do they see it from the point of view of Susanna, who's going through a real ordeal. Never, or rarely, there are only a couple of examples. Does the artist ever talk about the men as guilty? But more often, it's this kind of painting. This is Rembrandt's version. And Rembrandt is a little more realistic. The old men have crept up on Susanna, and they're pulling her garment off. And she is somewhat disturbed, but I think she's also looking at us looking at her. And there's some suggestion that by covering up parts of her body, she's actually calling attention to the body. And so I would suggest that she is taking a kind of Mae West pose, and she's doing a fan dance. And in a sense, she's teasing us. So Rembrandt isn't real clear on this, what his attitude towards Susanna is. Well, this is a painting by a woman on the same subject. Her name is Artemisia Gentileschi. And she's at the beginning of the 17th century in Italy. She's a woman, and she had these kinds of experiences. She was involved in a violent relationship with a man who smeared her. And she was innocent, but Artemisia has been smeared in art history books all the way down through history, even up to 1980, as a swinger, as a nifty lady. And it's not really true. The more you look into it, the more you find out. It's just men repeating stories. Because one good thing that's come out of the woman's movement, at the beginning of the 70s, a movement that's been very irritating but very necessary. Coming out of it is a lot of good, solid scholarship. And Artemisia Gentileschi has been thoroughly studied and reevaluated. And she turns, I mean, it appears that she's really a very important painter in the evolution of ideas. Well, she paints Susanna from the point of view of a woman. This is awkward, it's disturbing, it's embarrassing, it's terrifying. This could lead to rape. Rape is a nightmare that a woman fears. There's no attempt here to hide the body in the Mae West fashion. It's just simply there, and there's no attempt to turn it into an ideal abstraction. There's a wrinkle by the groin. There's a kind of flabbiness in the stomach. You can't see it in the slide, but there are wrinkles around the elbow. There's wrinkles on the neck. She's trying to be very faithful. This is a real, concrete, specific human being, a woman who is being violated by two of the trusted leaders of her community. The men conspire. They're on this sexual adventure. They're whispering to each other, what should we do with this woman who won't play our game? And then they plot to destroy her. I think also Artemisia leaves out the flowers, all the suggestive erotic elements. She places the woman on this cold piece of stone. It's a very sparse, ascetic kind of environment. And I think the message comes true very clearly that she knows what this means. Another theme. At the beginning of the 17th century, in the world of Holland, a very strong topic is the subject of the prodigal son. If you read the chapters of Luke, it talks about how the prodigal son went out and dwelt with harlots, and was a very popular theme. Maybe because of Calvinism, maybe in spite of Calvinism, which had some strong statements to make against this, but there's a lot of evidence that brothels increased in great numbers in the 17th century in the Protestant world, and the painters used that subject very openly and very willingly. And the women are always wenches. They're always dying to provide their services. They always have this low-cut dress. They hold musical instruments. They're seductive. They're willing participants. Their main reason for being is the sexual gratification of the men. But you don't make any judgment about this because it seems so kind of, I mean, everybody's so enthusiastic about it. And the subject is repeated over and over again in Dutch painting. This is by a man named Hunthorst, and it's called the Procurus. And this man is making a deal with this woman. This is a little more subtle, but this is by a man named Gerhard Terborch. It's called The Gallant Soldier. And it takes place in a very nice interior. It's a high-class place, but there's all kinds of signs that this is a brothel. The woman offers the man wine. I mean, she's preparing the man. There's fruit on the table, luscious fruits. This man, if we could see the detail of his face, he has glazed eyes. He's really far gone. He sits there in that slouchy position. His legs are spread apart, and he hands her money. I mean, but she is this very elegant, respectful, nice Calvinist Protestant woman playing this, doing her role. Well, there are hundreds of these kinds of paintings which seem to make this thing very legitimate and very normal, and good people do it, gallant people do it. Some of you might know Vermeer, and Vermeer's paintings are so aristocratic and so elegant and so refined. But the longer you stare at the paintings, you find clues that tell you this is a brothel. Well, this is an interesting, wonderful woman I've discovered this past year named Judith Lester, a 17th century Dutch woman. Let's see. I can't remember a lot about her biography, but her father recognized, let's see, I think her father was a teacher in the university in architecture, and I think he recognized some talents and helped her get educated in studio work, which was very difficult for a woman to do. And she would have known Rembrandt. She lived in the same city. She participated in this new kind of realism in the 17th century. Well, this very popular theme is handled in quite a different way by this woman, Judith Lester. This is called the proposition. It's cold in those houses. They don't have thermostats. If you can see down in the bottom in the dark, there are those little red dots. She has her feet on a foot warmer, and she's doing her textile work, embroidery, whatever. And the man touches her, and she has a lot of dignity. But she's embarrassed. There's this horrible silence as this aggressive man tries to get her. Well, maybe it's just simply a problem that she doesn't want to leave the foot warmer because it's cold in that room. But I think Judith Lester is trying to say something more about the indignity that's heaped upon women in this society at the beginning of the 17th century. And so in this detail, you get a little closer to this face. She really concentrates. She tries to ignore this man. It's a difficult thing that she's going through. I don't think he's going to get violent. But Judith Lester simply creates this image of profound dignity, and this is a real woman. And I think it's exciting that Judy Lester goes against the grain. And the same is true with Artemisia. She went against the grain. She bucked a lot of tradition in the way she handled Susanna. And Judith Lester is bucking a lot of tradition, a lot of commercial success in the way she sticks up for the woman and points up the fact that this is really wrong. This is a self-portrait of Judith. She had three children. Her husband was an artist. I think later in life she had great difficulty reconciling her personal career goals with her life as a mother and a parent. And that's a frequently troublesome problem in the biographies of women artists. A few generalizations about male forms and female forms, or male approaches to art and female approaches to art. This is a large steel piece by a man named Clement Meadmore. And it's a very powerful gesture. I think it's an interesting piece. All of his pieces are large, simple forms that go into knot-like shapes or writhe and twist. But they're very aggressive. They're very assertive. But they're, in a sense, they're not related to anything. They're not related to life. They're simply pure forms existing there on top of the landscape, sitting on their little concrete base. They're autonomous. They're self-contained. They don't have much to do with the biological processes of life, the cycles of nature. They don't have much to do with biography, with the fact that Judy Lester was an interesting woman in a Calvinist world, or that Artemisia had some problems with men. It's impersonal. And a lot of the work of men moves in this direction. It's articulate and rational in a sense, and clear and strong and assertive and independent and I can't think of 20 more adjectives here. This is another Clement Meadmore piece. Very large, strong, assertive gesture, and a gesture of authority comes at you like a clenched fist and smashes you in the face if you don't get out of its way. It's appealing, and it stands, in a sense, it stands in opposition to that, to the forest behind it. And a lot of architecture and sculpture has always had that point of view. It's maybe, in a sense, Mount Rushmore Memorial is something like that. It's these huge images of these presidents carved out of a mountain, kind of violating the mountain, making the mountain insignificant. And this, in a sense, is the way men are socialized. Men are socialized to make tough decisions. If you own an apartment house and somebody isn't paying the rent, you have to throw them out. If you have a property that's not producing income and for the health of the whole company, you have to get rid of that property, even if it means throwing away 100 jobs. You have to do it. There's no room in the marketplace for compassion and bleeding hearts. And I'm quoting here from a book that I've enjoyed by Lewis Hyde called The Gift. He talks about women as being compassionate. And this leads women in different directions. It leads them more towards life. Men talk about art. Women talk about life. Women talk about people. Women are engaged in teaching and caring and nurturing, providing for constructive leisure, good games that teach children things. Women are involved in the religious education of their children more than the men are. It's the women that go to the meetings at the church. The men go to the board of trustees and talk about the roof, but not parish education. So I'm making large generalizations here, but I don't have 14 hours to develop this. This is a woman, and she did a piece that I think will be helpful here. This is a woman, young woman named Alice Acock, featured in a recent Art in America magazine. It was kind of fun to look closely at her library. I have a lot of the same books, so I felt like we're buddies. But on her mother's farm, she's made some large structures. And this is a labyrinth. It's 12 feet high, and I don't know how wide it is, but it's a piece of sculpture. And it's also an experience. It's something that you have to participate with in order to get anything out of it. A labyrinth is frustrating. It can be terrifying. If you get lost, it's frightening. I mean, some of you are hunters or you're hikers, and suddenly you're out in the woods and you come across your own tracks, and it's terrifying. You go into a panic. So there's that dimension to the labyrinth. But also, you go inside of it. And there is the simple biological difference between men and women. Women's experience is inward. It's both inward and outward, but it's more inward than a man. And a man's biological nature is external. Woman's is internal. Things happen inside of women. Things happen outside of men. And so the labyrinth becomes a kind of wonderful metaphor for the female experience. And you can think of the Egyptian pyramid as the male form. You don't go into it. You walk around it. You're always detached from it. It's immovable. It's static. It's changeless. It's eternal. But you always stay outside of it. And the labyrinth is nothing if you don't go into it and participate with it. And so I think there's a lot about women's art that involves this kind of participation, and there's a lot about men's art that keeps you at a distance, such as in these Clement Meadmore pieces. This is the Vietnam Veterans Memorial on the Mall in Washington, and it's a female work of art. It's a piece of modern sculpture designed by a young Asian American woman, Maya Yin Ling. She was 21 years old at the time. It was an assignment for her architectural landscape design class at Yale. Her teacher gave her a B on the project. The teacher also entered the competition, but he was rejected. And it was a very controversial piece. A lot of influential people tried to get the jury disbanded. Ross Perot, who has billions of dollars, really went all out to junk this project and to get rid of this creepy young woman, a A woman is incapable of making a veterans memorial because she didn't go to NAM. A Chinese American woman is not really American, so she's not capable of doing this. And furthermore, a young kid isn't able to do anything. A 21-year-old, what do they know about anything? It's a black polished marble work that's very disturbing. It's a spatial temporal event that you have to participate in. She proposed that the names of the veterans be listed in the order in which their deaths were reported. So you have to search. You have to go through this dreadful experience of time and space in order to find your brother's name. And as you know, when families come here, sometimes they're destroyed. It is so painful. You also see yourself reflected in the black. So you are there. You're in it. You're also in the earth, where we bury seeds for resurrection and we bury bodies. The names start at the gash, at the meeting of these two lines, these two 250-foot long lines, and then they proceed out to the end, and then you have to go back over to the other side, and then you get back to the middle, but you're back where you started. It never ends, so it's without a beginning or an ending, as that war was. And out there, one of the arms reaches out to the George Washington Memorial or monument. That is a male form. It's an anonymous, kind of neutral physical fact that stands out there by itself. You can climb inside of it, but that's not the point of it. You don't really enter into it. You stay outside of it. Maya Yin Ling's piece demands participation. It's a labyrinth. You have to come into it. You have to be a part of it. And it deals with life and with human experiences. And the George Washington piece is a kind of distorted historicism. It's a quotation of an Egyptian obelisk. And it doesn't have anything to do with Egypt at all. In a sense, it doesn't have anything to do with anything. I'm being unpatriotic here. I really like the monument, and it's exciting when you fly into Washington to see that vertical landmark. But if you think about it, it really holds you away, and it's inhuman. I think it's a very exciting piece of modern art, modern sculpture, that manifests one dimension that seems to be coming through in women's work, and that is that women's work demands dialogue. You have to respond. And everything that women are doing today is a conversation. It's a question, and you can't ignore it. You have to answer it somehow. And Maya's work here is a very disturbing question. George Washington simply reaffirms probably something that we all already believe in all the time, and there's no debate. Friday I'll talk about quilt making, and quilt making is a participatory activity involving community. It's a group of women getting together to help each other, sometimes to resolve the isolation of living in far-off places, in ranches in Texas or wherever. But it's an art form that's been seen as minor and insignificant, but more and more, I know many of you are aware of the fact that there's a great deal of interest in this activity. Quilts have something to do with the life process, with biological necessity, with keeping warm. It's part of life. It's part of life cycles. It has to do with the family. It has to do with the community. It's a powerful art form. But then an interesting dimension of it is that it's anonymous. We do know a few names, Molly O'Grady or whoever, Mrs. Swenson. But that's not important. What was important was the process of pulling community together, a process of building this relationship among these women. And today there are men involved in this activity, and I'll mention that on Friday when I talk about this interesting tradition. Well, I'm going to just dash through a couple of interesting women, and I guess I better not say too much. Paula Moderson Becker, a little-known woman who doesn't appear in the art history books. All the male German expressionist artists get their due. One thing that I mentioned is there seems to be a strong emphasis on autobiography in women's art. And I'm starting out with a series of self-portraits of Paula Moderson Becker. This is 1898. Is that right? Yes. A self-portrait at 98. She's always looking into herself, seeing the world in relationship to herself. This is 1900. And she felt very proud that day and self-assured, I think. Or maybe she's just looking down her nose at us. This is 1903. Maybe she's a perplexed, ambivalent, ambiguous teenager here. Not quite, but she lived in a rural area. She really loved peasant art and rural people. She's kind of a romantic. Her work was persecuted and hunted out for destruction by the Nazis, who didn't want Germany represented by such homely people. So she was labeled a decadent, degenerate artist. This is a self-portrait on her 6th wedding anniversary. She resisted marriage fiercely. She knew that it would have a dangerous impact on her desire to be a painter. She finally yielded, and tragically, she died as a result of complications following childbirth. But this is a self-portrait at, I think it's 1908, with a self-portrait with a camellia blossom. And this is the last self-portrait. She liked these strong, chunky, sculptural kinds of forms and very simple shapes. There are some interesting images of the mother and child, and certainly here we're not involved in anything like what we started out with. This woman is a rock. She is the earth. And she cares for her child. But she's no goddess like the Nazis wanted painted. All German women were to look like those Titian Venus figures. This is a mother, a standing or a kneeling mother feeding her child, like a strong piece of, like a mountain, like a strong piece of sculpture. And a young child in the birch forest playing a flute. She was a good friend of Rilke, the poet. She lived in a community like Holden, a community in northern Germany of artists and poets and gardeners, and I don't know enough about that community, but I suspect Holden has kinship with that place. And old people whose life goes inward, it's inward, it's spiritual, as they face eternity. An old woman praying, and there's a kind of an intensity about the religious sensitivities of older people. And another woman who gets some good press in the books, but not enough, is Katie Kollwitz. The Norwegian painter Edvard Munch gets pages and pages in the textbooks, and Katie Kollwitz gets about 2 lines. And Edvard Munch's work was about his own problems, his own neuroses, his own navel, his own hang-ups. Katie Kollwitz is an image of self-denial, self-abnegation. Her focus is on other people, on other mothers, on other children. Edvard Munch wailed about the loss of his own sister. Katie Kollwitz, who lost children in war, in 2 wars, World War I and World War II, and was hounded by the Nazis, and knew pain and all of that. She didn't think about herself. She thought about this larger community. Her father told her, "You're really ugly." What a way to get a start in life. He said, "You better go out and learn a trade because no one's ever going to want to marry you." There's all kinds of statements like that she talks about in her letters. But she married a physician, and she had children, and she had a very productive life. She's probably not a Twiggy or anything, but she had a very strong, solid kind of face. This is a self-portrait. This is called Bread. And her main medium was printmaking, black and white printmaking, because she wanted to reproduce these works. She did a lot of things for posters, for hunger campaigns. She worked with Herbert Hoover in Save the Children campaigns. This doesn't really need any comment. I use the word compassion, and it obviously comes through very strongly here. This is Death Seizes the Woman. And she screams because the child will be left alone. It's a very strong composition of forms, the skeleton reaching around, and she holds the child's face, and she's terrified. She knows what that means because it was happening in her world, in World War I and World War II, and then it happens anyway. Young mothers dying from hunger and disease and so on. She used very simple means to make very powerful and effective statements. These are the mothers huddled together against these forces beyond themselves. And this is a self-portrait. She knows her days are numbered and death is touching her shoulder. And the last one is her funerary sculpture, which she made for her own grave, resting in his hands, the hands of God, enfolded her. And she has a lot of comfort in that. It's a really moving piece in bronze, a relief as part of her sculpture. Let's see, I don't know. We've got 2, 3, 4 minutes. I don't know if we have time, but I wanted to bring one more woman photographer, Dorothea Lange, who, this is a self-portrait. I'm not a self-portrait, but this is Dorothea Lange as an older woman. But she did this famous photograph of the Oki woman. Dorothea Lange was interested in lobbying Congress to become more sensitive to the plight of the migrant workers in the 30s. There was general indifference to this vast army of people floating around in the Southwest and in California. And she used her camera to call attention to that condition. This woman died last summer, and she was identified, and she was on the front pages of a lot of newspapers. But she looks out at that bleak landscape. She didn't spy on people. She always had their permission to take their photograph. And I don't think she asked her to look distressed or anything. I think she just took pictures until she got the moment that she wanted. She did spy on this man. She was in her studio and saw this bread line down below on the street. This is a very famous photograph. Probably a very young woman, but she's ravaged by the social condition of the 20s and 30s. A Texas woman. Hands. The father is probably a tenant farmer, but there's still that kind of compassion there between the father and the child. The worker hoeing the fields. This is the migrant's route. It's endless. There's nothing on it except this is a road in Texas, and this is a homeless family, and they have to walk down that road. The two photographs together are really, really hard to think about. And these were made for propaganda purposes to sensitize the legislature in Washington, which had a lot of problems, but needed to do something. This man is out of work, sitting on the edge of a pea field, and there's no work today. These are 6 tenant farmers who have just lost their farms, and they're kind of cocky. They'll make it. But this is a photograph she took 30 minutes later, and the reality is sinking in. There's a whole series of on this theme as she tries to get deeper and deeper into the reality of this nightmare of the Dust Bowl era, the Depression. It's a very dignified photograph of a man's back. It's a very strong form. And there, I don't know if there's an argument going on here about wages, possibly. Those clenched fists certainly speak. The title of this photograph is "It Was a Tough Weekend." And it says a lot. You can see that the crow's feet on the eyes over there on the left, just suggesting the kind of anguish. This is called "The Damaged Child." The background of corrugated metal is a powerful environment for that photograph. Drought farmers or dryland farmers. They probably have all answers to the problems of the world. I think I won't talk about this person, Diane Arbus, but I'll just show the pictures. This is a lesbian couple. I wasn't going to say anything, but called Good Friends. Diane Arbus, I am going to say something. Diane Arbus, in a sense, shows us people that we'd like not to think about. Is she just appealing to our voyeuristic instincts, or do these people really deserve to be heard? Diane Arbus photographed dwarfs and crippled people and perverts and just sort of the dregs of New York City. This is a woman. This is the way she is most of the time, but she has this powerful urge to dress up and masquerade like this person. These are the same people. Why does she do this? She's very serious about it. Diane Arbus got to know this woman, and she let her in on her secret. That these are the same people. Well, they're part of life. I talked about this woman in an art history class, and then I asked for responses, and most people thought these people should be seen and should have a chance to be heard. This is a young child. This was during the troubled times of the Vietnam War. This is a young child in Central Park holding a toy hand grenade, trying to be mean. And this is a young couple that's much too young to get married, acting like adults. And there are a lot of photographs of parents who dress their little kids up like old adults, make three-year-olds wear tuxedos and strange things like that. I think Diane Arbus should be seen. Her husband was the psychiatrist on MASH, Sidney Alan Arbus. They were both fashion photographers, and he moved into television, and she moved off into this strange world of the sort of trash of society. It's time to go. Our time is up. Thank you.